And I saw that my first guest was Alexander Lerman talking to me about his book, which is called The Windsors at War. I thought, not another book about Harry and Meghan. But it's not. Not at all. It's about the Nazi threat to the crown. Alexander, you're very welcome to the programme. How are you?
Joe, it's a pleasure to be speaking to you today.
Oh, I'm delighted that you think so. And I'm looking forward to the chat. It was never timed as brilliantly as this book because, I mean, have they ever not been at war, the royals?
Well, no. I mean, I think there's always been a tension between the royal family. It's just that it's spilled over spectacularly twice, actually. Once, obviously, in the time dealt with in the book, between 1937 and 1945, and of course, the present day. So It's a book that has unexpected topical resonance, I think we're calling it.
Indeed it has. So why did you decide that this would be the topic for your next book, your current book?
Well, I just done a book about the abdication crisis called, fittingly enough, The Crowning Crisis. And I finished writing that and I thought, but there's this amazing story that I want to tell, because obviously that book ended with the ex-Edward VIII sailing off into the darkness. Mm. But I thought, well, I want to know what happens next. Okay. And what I realized while I was doing my research for that book was there was all this material that I was seeing relating to what happened, which was going to answer the question I think everybody wants to know, which was the Duke of Windsor really a Nazi? And I hope that I managed to say in fairly conclusive detail in the book what his Nazi sympathies were, why he wasn't, you know, a fully paid-up Nazi, but he was still somebody who I think committed treason and should have been in prison for it.
Mm. And for the ordinary person on the street, Edward abdicated because he fell in love with a married woman, let's say, all right? And he wanted to be with her. That was it. Bertie, who was not at all prepared to become king, had to step in, and that wasn't an easy transition. So that's what we on the street would have understood. Now, not that I was here, or probably you weren't there at that time, but people on the street, that's what they were taught. Can you tell us what other dynamics were at play within the Windsor family that made this completely, an awful situation?
Well, it was an awful situation because you had these two opposing brothers, but Edward had abdicated quite willingly in one sense because he wanted to marry Wallis. But he got very angry very quickly because he felt that she wasn't being given the respect that she deserved. Mm-hmm. He felt that he wasn't being given the money that he deserved. And so there's this enormous resentment and ill will that kicked in more or less straight away after the abdication. And so the book begins with Edward in exile preparing to marry Wallis, but also incredibly resentful and bitter that no members of the royal family went to the wedding and it wasn't really acknowledged or received with any kind of respect that he felt he was due. And I think that we can see a parallel between Harry always moaning on about how sad that he doesn't feel he's given the respect that he's due with his great-great-uncle, because there's a real sense of both men that they're petty about what they felt that they weren't given. And that you can see all this with Duke of Windsor. You can see that there are these long letters, which I found for the first time, that he wrote to Bertie, now for George VI. Mm-hmm. And he complains about everything. I mean, he's basically moaning constantly. And of course, the answer that George VI has to make back to him is, well, you abdicated, you brought all this on yourself.
Right. Was he a spoiled brat?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I mean, most members of the royal family are spoiled to a greater or lesser extent, so I'm probably narrowing it down very much.
Mm. In the little preview that I got in relation to the book, it says that it answers the simple question, how did this squabbling, dysfunctional family manage to put their differences aside and unite to help win the greatest conflict of their lifetime? The greatest conflict, obviously, would be the conflict among themselves, not necessarily World War II. So how did it happen? Who were the major players in that?
Well, the major person who brought them together, if anyone did, was Winston Churchill, because what he was able to do was that he was able to take George VI, who was a rather hapless, rather pathetic figure before the outbreak of war, and the two men worked incredibly closely and well together. Mm. And because of this, George actually grew in stature until by the end of the war, he really was the king that Britain needed. Mm. And I think that's fascinating because while his brother was exiled to the Bahamas because of his, dubious Nazi sympathies, you can see George VI gradually growing in stature, growing in authority, and with Churchill's partnership, and I think that's the right word that I would use, you can really see the two men actually uniting and facing this enemy. And of course, then you've got the other members of the family as well, who are fascinating characters. You've got the youngest of them all, the Duke of Kent, who died in mysterious circumstances in a plane crash in 1942. You've got the Duke of Gloucester, who's completely useless and was nicknamed the Unknown Soldier.
Right.
Not particularly a distinguished military career.
Mm-hmm. The importance then of the relationship between the Crown and the British Prime Minister of the day. People that watch The Crown, the TV series, will get a slight sense of that. But when you talk about the work that Winston Churchill did with the Windsors, and you look at the work that Tony Blair did, particularly around the time that Diana died, the work that he did with the royals, it seems to take up a lot of time for the British prime ministers, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think that the prime minister should have it in their job description, handling a member of a royal family. I mean, this is one of those things that you're never elected on that basis. But, I mean, The Crown is a series that I'm sure that your listeners will have mixed opinions about. Mm-hmm. I certainly do. One thing I think it's excellent on is the relationship between the monarch and the prime minister, because it shows you how close and important that relationship is.
Mm.
And certainly, I mean, because what's interesting about George VI is that his first prime minister was Neville Chamberlain, and Neville Chamberlain behaved towards him as if he was his son.
Okay.
And so there's this sort of paternalistic relationship that grew up there. But Chamberlain was completely useless. Imagine having a father figure who basically, when push comes to shove, can't actually deliver what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
So that's why the Churchill relationship is a much more significant one.
What role, if any, did the Queen Mother, as she became known to us, play in this particular situation?
Well, the Queen Mother was somebody who basically, I mean, there's a famous line that Queen Mary, the King's mother, managed the Queen Mother. The Queen Mother managed the King.
Mm-hmm.
And she was somebody who was very much in charge, because she'd always known that her husband was somebody who wasn't as strong or outgoing a figure as his brother. And so she was somebody who was always making sure that he was doing the right thing, that he wasn't uncomfortable and so on. And so I think that while you could say that she was having a backseat driver, and what I found fascinating was I found various letters during my research, one of which she's quite open about her utter contempt for the Duke of Windsor, her brother-in-law.
Right. Mm.
And of course, these things are quite interesting, because usually documents like that tend to be put out of sight and not really brought into the public domain. But there's one where she's saying how young and beautiful he looks, but she doesn't trust him an inch.
Right.
So there's a real sense of animosity there.
I don't know if you can answer this question. It's not part of a question about the book, but the crisis that the Windsors went through between 1937 and 47, you know, the time that you're looking at in the book, if it was today and social media, the media, and so on and so forth, would they have survived?
I think it's a very interesting question, because I explored this in The Crown and Crisis as well. I mean, the idea that the monarchy has been teetering on the edge of existential crisis between the beginning of 1936 and the coronation, or at least the accession of Elizabeth II, is essentially the reason why, because I've got another book about this coming out next year.
Okay.
And I find it a fascinating period, the idea that you've got these constant blows to the institution and the reputation of the monarchy, these almost existential blows. And people are beginning to question, in this era of war and this era of change, what is the royal family actually for?
Mm.
And it's the first time people have really been asking that. It's the first time that people have been openly advocating, if not quite republicanism, certainly these existential ideas of what are we getting out of all this? What is it, the point of it? And the Duke of Windsor, I think, was the worst possible advert you could have for any kind of hereditary monarchy whatsoever.
Mm. How deep did the links with Germany, Nazi Germany, run with Edward?
Rather deeper than anyone would have liked. I mean, he was somebody who, from the mid-1930s, he was openly giving speeches in which he was saying, it's time that we made peace with Germany. The First World War is a long time behind us. Germany is an obvious natural ally for us, and we should, you know, be on good terms with them.
Mm.
And he was close to the absolutely fully paid up Nazi von Ribbentrop, who was a British ambassador at the end of his reign. And of course, when he went out to Germany in 1937 with Wallace Simpson in the autumn of that year, he was notoriously photographed with Hitler, who he had a meeting with. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if you were going to be generous, which I'm not inclined to be, you could say that he's going out to Germany in a rather misguided but well-meaning spirit of trying to understand why the country had had such success in terms of this industrial revolution it was undergoing. But what I would say is more accurate is that, in fact, he was impressed by Hitler. He saw him as somebody who was a vigorous reforming figure, somebody who he would have quite liked to have been like. And you can see that, you know, I mean, even decades after the Second World War, he was quoted by one friend of his as saying, "I never thought Hitler was such a bad chap." So there's a real sense that if a Jehovah's Witness wasn't a Nazi in terms of he didn't go around wearing a uniform or anything like that, Nazi sympathies were absolutely a central facet of his character.
I was talking to somebody one day a number of years ago, here in Spain, as it happens, and we were talking about history and World War II and the royal family. And he made a comment to me that stunned me. And my late father, at the time I was talking to him, and he would have been a great man to have studied World War II. And I asked him, did he ever hear this particular comment or this suggestion? He said, no, I never did. So, but I'm going to ask you, in that this particular individual said to me that Edward's cozying up to Hitler was all about a promise that Hitler made to him that when Hitler invaded and took over Britain, that he would reinstate him as the king or the caretaker. Did you ever hear that?
Yes, I've heard various variants on that story or that rumour. I mean, what's very interesting for me is that I was given fairly free access to the Royal Archives through the last two books that I wrote, which is obviously a great privilege, because the Royal Archives is where every single historian writing about this period wants to go, because that's where the most revelatory, the most sensational material is. That's where you've got all the actual letters between the royal brothers and so forth. The one thing that I never found was any kind of information of that ilk. I mean, you don't see the letter from Edward saying, "Good news, when Hitler wins, I'm going to become king again," which is a shame, because I think that it would be a hilarious letter apart from anything else.
It would, yeah, absolutely.
It was well known enough during his lifetime for people to be commenting of his, you know, talk at dinner that, oh, well, you know, if I was to be asked to come back, I wouldn't complain too much.
Do you think he was... I suppose he was, but I'm going to ask you anyway the question. Was he eternally bitter? Was he bitter for the remainder of his days that he had to step down?
I think initially he was euphoric that he was leaving because he never liked being king. He never wanted any of the responsibilities of monarchy. I mean, the only aspect of monarchy that Edward VIII actually liked was he liked being able to deal with people in a sort of hail fellow well-met way, on a sort of superficial, almost matey level. But he had no interest whatsoever in any of the constitutional, any of the religious aspects of it. That was all just boring to him. So he was glad to be rid of that. But the problem, what he hadn't realised was that after he abdicated, he was beginning to become a non-person.
Right.
The rest of his life was pretty much consisting of things being found for him to do. And I think we can see the echo of this in the present-day royal family. I mean, we have these figures. I mean, Prince Harry is probably the most obvious one, who don't actually have a role within public life, and they don't, not really anything that can be found for them to do. So if they stomp off to California in a huff, all they're doing is living up to their forebears, really.
I know it's a factual book, but is it written in a way that there's a hero and there's a villain?
Lots of heroes and lots of villains.
Okay. All right.
Overflowing with them both.
Okay. And finally, is there anything in the book that could, that the current royal family could learn that would help them in their current crisis?
I think that I'm going to be sending copies to both Prince William and Prince Harry, courtesy of their various factotums. Mm-hmm. And I would hope, but if they can find the time to, you know, when we're not fighting each other, they could actually sit down and read it and maybe take a lesson or two from history.
Well, when you're dedicating it, do mention I send my regards, won't you?
Of course.
Absolutely. Listen, the book is called The Windsors at War, The Nazi Threat to the Crown, written by Alexander Larman. Alexander, we have that on sale on our virtual bookstore on our website, which is tre.radio, so our listeners can get their hands on it quickly. I wish you well with it, and thank you for talking to me today about the book.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure, Jim.
Delighted to talk to you.